Hi, everyone. My name's Larry Adams, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Boy, it's a pleasure to be here. I want to tell you, man, after Benoit, I don't know if I can talk. Really, it's just a real honor to be on the program with you, Benoit. It's really been touched me to get to hear you tonight. The faith that you had, just been real good. I'm real choked up emotionally right now. I thought, damn, man, we should shut up. Well, get me so choked up I can't talk, but I'm glad to be here. I want to thank the committee for having me here. I've been blessed this weekend. My brother Ralph's with me. It's the first time we've been out of state to a conference together. It's a real special weekend to have my brother with me. We've just been treated wonderful. It's, everything's just been great up till now. I told somebody once, the phone can ring and somebody can ask you to come to one of these things and you get so excited. So you're ready to get up here and talk, you wish you hadn't answered the phone. That's the way I feel every time, but I know I'll be all right once I get talking. And I want to tell you my sobriety date's November the 7th, 1978. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, and my sponsor's Jack S. from Louisville, Kentucky. And I want you all to report to him that I said Jack S., not Jack A. Sometimes I call him that. But Jack's been good. He's been a good sponsor for me, and I love him very much. And he's helped me with this program because he's taught me by example. And I think that's real important. I've learned a lot from him. I just celebrated 18 years, and me and my wife's been married 36 years. And I told her we was even. We had 18. We had 18 years of the drinking, and we celebrated 18 years in AA and Al-Anon, and I said, we're even. And she said, what about the dry drunks? You can't get ahead of an Al-Anon, I won't tell you that. I guess I'll never get caught up. But she couldn't come this weekend, and my brother come with me, and I talked to her on the phone. And I told her one time, I said, I don't know what I'm going to say. You're always going to say something real magnificent. She said, why don't you tell them what you know? Well, that limits me. And that's what I'm going to do tonight, is to tell you about me. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt real unique. I was sure nobody had ever lived the way I had lived. And I went to my first conference, and I was 3 months sober, and a guy named Johnny H. got up to talk. And he had on a big, nice suit like I have tonight, and he was all dressed up, and I was sitting on the dead back row, and I didn't want to be there, but my wife, Al-Anon sponsor, and her husband drove us there. And I remember looking up at Johnny, and I thought, now what is this slick dude got to say to a guy like me? And I'll tell you what he had to say. He told my soul. He touched me, and he gave me hope. And every time I walk up behind one of these microphones, that's what I want to do. Because maybe somebody out there felt like I felt, and I hope I can give you some hope. Because since I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous, my life is unbelievable, and I'll tell you a little bit about it later. But to tell you how good my life is, I got to tell you how bad my life was. And I'm not proud of my story. It took me a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 38 years old when I got here. And I experienced my first drunk when I was 12. So you know right away I'm hard-headed. I was born and raised down in Louisville, Kentucky, from a large family. We lived down in a section of Louisville that was rough. There was a bar on every corner. When Benoit was talking about honky-tonks, and then I said, yes, because we had the honky-tonks, and they was on every corner, and there was a lot of action, and it was a Catholic neighborhood, and there was large families down there. Now, we wasn't Catholic, but my daddy took lessons from them, because they wound up being 13 kids in our family. He said he was practicing the rhythm method. But it was an exciting family, we provided the weekend entertainment for the neighborhood. We was the Adams family long before they come on television, let me tell you. And there was always something going on in my house. I had all these older brothers. There was 9 boys in our family. And there was always somebody getting drunk. There was always a police car at our house. There was always some action. And I can remember growing up, we would be up on the corner and the police car would head down. We lived on a section called Rudd Avenue. And when a cop car turned off Northwestern Parkway and headed for Rudd Avenue, everybody run to our house. Because they knew the Adamses was performing. That would embarrass me, And I remember growing up feeling embarrassed. My daddy was a good man. He made us a good living. But I know today my dad was an alcoholic. And I loved him and I hated him. I couldn't understand that. When my daddy worked and made a good living and done nice things for us, I loved him. But on Friday night, he would stop up to the beer joint and get drunk. And man, when he'd come home, there was action at our house. And him and my mom would get to arguing, and my daddy would get butcher knives out and chase my mother through the house. And I can remember hiding under beds and in closets to get away from my dad. You know, I couldn't understand how anybody could drink like that. I didn't know nothing about alcoholism. I heard an Al-Anon say there's three kinds of drinkers in the world. There's a social drinker, there's a heavy drinker, and there's an alcoholic. Now, how you tell them apart is a social drinker going to a beer joint. I call them all joints. I never hung in nightclubs as beer joints. And if you order him a drink, and you get ready to take a drink, and you look down and see his flies in his drink. And you call for the waitress and you say, honey, there's a fly in my drink. Would you bring me another drink? He'd give him another drink. Now, the old heavy drinker will come in there, and he'll sit down and order him a drink. He'll look down and see there's a fly in his drink. He'll pick that fly up, put it on the table, and drink that drink. Now, the good old alcoholic will walk into a joint. He'll sit down and order him a drink. He'll see there's a fly in there, and he'll reach down and grab that fly and holler, spit it out, spit it out. That's the kind of drinker I turned out to be. I didn't want that fly to get none of that. But I didn't know my dad was an alcoholic. You know, I just knew he drank too much, and I knew I'd never be like him. And little did I know, at 12 years old, I was going to begin to experience with alcohol. I was up on a corner. All of us kids kind of hung out on the corner. When you got 13 kids, you get out of the house, you know. And I started hanging on them street corners down there. And I can remember when I was 9 years old, I used to go to a boys' club. And to go to this boys' club, I had to walk up this section of Portland. And it was a rough place. There was a bar on every corner. And I had to walk by one particular joint. And it was the most fantastic place I ever seen. And I was real little, and if I got up on my tiptoes, they had a round window in the front of it. And I could look in that beer joint. And I had older brothers in there, and it was the most exciting places. They were shooting and stabbing. And the band played behind chicken wire, and the tables was bolted to the floor. And man, it was happening in there. And I thought, at 9 years old, looking through that window, I thought, man, I can't wait to get in there. Now, that's not much of an ambition to have when you're 9 years old. And, you know, I was going to get my wish sooner than I really thought I would. Because at 12 years old, I was hanging on that corner, and they said, Larry, we're going to pool our money together and get something to drink tonight. Do you want to go with us? I had no experience with alcohol at 12 years old. My dad used to make homemade wine, but when you got eight brothers, you got to be quick. And, you know, I wasn't quick enough. But I wanted to go with them guys that night, not because I wanted to drink alcohol. I wanted to be part of that crowd on that corner. And I would have went anywhere and done anything to be part of that crowd. And I went with them at 12 years old, and I got drunk, and I got sick, and I got in trouble with the police. Now, I could sit down, because that happened to me for the next 25 years, over and over and over. You know, I always thought it was going to be different, but I had a good time that night. They told me I did, you know. Had a blackout the first night, and man, they was telling me all the crazy stuff I did, you know, patting me on the back, and I liked the attention it got me, and I did that over and over and over. Had a lot of problems in school because I'd start drinking early. I was the class clown in school. You know, I performed for my classmates, and I was always in some kind of jackpot in school. And I finally got old enough to quit school, and I had a brother. He was a jockey, and he was a rich, famous jockey at one time in his life, and he went all over the United States, and he used to come home for visits. And he would bring jockeys home with him. And he would go up into them nice bars where the band played behind chicken wire. And he would throw $20 bills around like he just printed them. And people would flock around him and tell him what a wonderful guy he was. And I thought, that's it. I'm going away and I'm going to become a jockey. You know, I didn't weigh hardly 100 pounds. And I was small, little skinny runt. I thought, I'm going away and be a rich, famous jockey. And I won't have to worry about nothing. And I did. You know, I told my dad I was going on a racetrack. My dad had kind of a rule at our house. It was called 16 and out. I thought that was awful unfair, but if I had 13 kids, I'd have that rule too, you know. But I told him I was going to work on the racetrack, and I did. I left home, and I went to Boston, Massachusetts to seek my fame and fortune. You know, boy, when I got on the racetrack, they talk about crossing over the invisible line. I immediately fell in with the people that drank and drugged. Now, if you've never heard about me, don't become too alarmed. The only thing I was going to ride up in Boston was a beach called Riviera Beach. I passed out on that beach night after night after night. You know, because I started drinking and running the country. And I remember being up there one day, and I looked up, and one of my brothers was there. My brother's a lot of my story. It was my brother Norman, and I thought, well, I'll be darned, man. He loves me so much, he'd come to see me 1,000 miles. And I got to talking to him. I found out he was hiding from the FBI. That's what he was doing up there. He got in some serious trouble, and he come up to Boston. And when he got up there, we really got to partying. He was 5 years older than me, and he was kind of my hero. You know, Norman done most of my fighting. I would start fights, and he would finish them. He liked to fight, and I kept him in training. I remember one night in a beer joint, I started a big ruckus, and he had to clean it up. He come over to the table, and he was wore out and, you know, cleaning up my mess. He said, Larry, I hate to tell you this, but when you drink, you got an alligator mouth and a hummingbird ass. That was me, man. I could start them. I just couldn't finish them. But when he got up there, we got to partying real hard, and it wasn't long till the FBI figured out where he was. They come up to Boston, they arrested him, brought him back to Louisville, Kentucky. And I got homesick. And I was wondering what was happening to him. And I hadn't called my mom and dad. I hadn't wrote a letter. You know, it's just like I forgot Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm having a good time, but I thought, I think I'll go back to Louisville. I know my mom and dad's missing me. And I remember coming in, and my mom was glad to see me, and my dad come in from work, and I was sitting in the kitchen. He said, Christ sakes, are you back again? You know, and I didn't like him before, and I didn't like him then. And he told me, he said, Larry, if you're going to stay here, you're not going to do like your brothers. You got a mind if you're going to live here. Well, I don't have to tell you, I didn't live very long. It wasn't long till my dad asked me to leave again. Now, when you're from a large family, it takes a while to use them up. And my brother Ralph is here with me. Ralph had got married and didn't live too far away. And when Dad run me off, I went to Ralph's house and I knocked on his door and I said, Ralph, Dad run me off. Can I stay all night? And Ralph was drinking pretty heavy. And he said, well, yeah, brother, come on in. And I want you all to know it took him a year to get me out of his house. You know, I was like bubblegum, man. When I got in, I stuck, you know. I'm hanging in them joints by now. You know, if you had a phony ID, you could get in them joints. And I'm hanging in them joints, and there ain't much good going on in my life. You know, I'm always in some kind of trouble with the police. I'm fighting and carrying on, and there wasn't a lot of good things happening. But when I was raised in my neighborhood, there was a little girl in my neighborhood. I knew her since she was 5 years old. She lived about a half a block from me. And I never paid her no attention. And one evening, I'm standing up on this library hill, and I'm about half drunk, and she come up the street. And she had grew up, and she had got pretty, and she had what I wanted, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. And I began to pursue her. Now, we had to sneak around because her daddy hated me, and I couldn't understand what her daddy had against a nice guy like me, you know. But I know today, you know, her daddy would be out in the yard, and I'd be coming in from an all-night drunk. And I'd throw a beer bottle at him and curse him and couldn't understand why he didn't want his daughter to go out with me. You know, but me and her, we snuck around and we eventually got married and we was going to live happily ever after. Now, this girl was a good Christian girl. She went to a religious school. She studied the Bible. She didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She didn't cuss. She didn't gamble. She didn't know how to have any fun at all. And boy, that was all going to change, I'm going to tell you. And how she got hooked up with me, I'll never know. And I used to go up to this Christian school, and the teachers would see me, and they'd say, Barbara, you stay away from that Adams boy. He's trouble. But she flunked that course. She told me later she thought she could change me. And I want to tell you what, she tried everything in the world, and nothing worked. We got married, and we began to have kids. Man, we had one kid right away. It wasn't long till we had our second kid. And it wasn't long till she was pregnant with our third kid. I thought we was going to have 13 till we found out what was causing it. And our life's already a shambles because I'm not coming home at night. I'm staying in them honky-tonks and them bars. I'm getting locked up on a regular basis, and my charges are getting more serious. Me and her's arguing. You know, things wasn't real good. And I'm running with the wildest crowd I can find in Louisville. We would cruise the streets of Louisville on Friday and Saturday night. And if you left something out in your yard and we wanted it, we took it. I thought the world was a mark. You know, I thought I could take whatever I wanted. There wasn't no consequences. Well, I want to tell you, when you live like I do, you got to pay the consequences sooner or later. And at 23 years old, married with two kids, my wife pregnant with her third child, I found myself standing in front of one of them judges. and he sentenced me to 10 years in the Kentucky State Reformatory. And my wife was in that courtroom, and she was pregnant with our third child. She began to cry. And my mom and dad was in that courtroom, and they began to cry. And I remember looking back, and I thought, what the hell are they crying about? I'm going to the penitentiary. You know, I tell you that because at 23 years old, I had lost the ability to care about another human being. The only person I cared about was myself. And away I went to the penitentiary, and guess what? All my friends was there. They took me in, and it looked like old home week. They said, hey, Larry, what took you so long? And I thought, I wonder how they knew I was coming. You know, it's a cinch when you're living like I live. My wife went on aid for dependent children, and she had our third baby when I was in that penitentiary, and I held that baby for the first time behind bars. And she used to ride a bus up to see me every Sunday. And I'd sit in that visiting room, and I'd make her all them promises, and I meant every one of them. I'd say, oh, baby, you wait for me, and when I get out of here, things are going to be different. But see, I found out about AA in the penitentiary. A guy come up to me one night, and they had a great big old loop, and when you didn't have nothing to do, which was most of the time in the penitentiary, you know, you got out and you walked this loop. And I'm walking this loop one night, and a buddy of mine come up, and he said, Larry, you want to go to a meeting? I thought, well, you know, I ain't got much going tonight. I said, what kind of meeting? He said, an AA meeting. And I looked at him like he was crazy. I said, what in the world would I want to go to an AA meeting for in a penitentiary? But he said something that motivated me. He said, might look good to the parole board. I said, where's the meeting at? You know? And I want you to know, for the next 18 months, I went to an AA meeting once a week, whether I needed it or not. And I want to tell you tonight that you can come to an AA meeting and you can sit in that chair till your butt falls off. If you don't hear nothing, it ain't going to help you. And I never heard nothing. I thought they brought them speakers in there to entertain me. You know, and on Wednesday night they would have this meeting. They'd bring a speaker in from outside and he would tell his story like I'm doing tonight. And the meeting would get over with and we'd start back to the dormitory. And I'd look at my buddy and I'd say, man, that guy's had a rough life, ain't he? Now, he went out the front gate and went home to his wife and killed, and I went back and got locked up. My sponsor told me when I got here, the word insanity ought to come easy for me, you know. But I finally made parole, and I went home to Barbara, my three kids, and we was going to live happily ever after. And we did for 2 weeks. You know, we went on one of them extended honeymoons you got to go on when you've been gone. You got to get caught up. And I'm going to tell you, it don't take long to get caught up. And I got bored. And I thought, I wonder what my buddies are doing up at the corner. And I told Barbara, I said, I'll be back after a while. I'm going to run up and see my buddy. And I went into my favorite beer joint. All my buddies were there. They said, hey, Larry, we're glad you're back. Have a beer. And I hadn't drank nothing for over 2 years. And I picked that bottle of beer up, and it was like I never left. We tried a geographical cure. My wife said, I know what's wrong with you. She said, it's the people you run with. And I took her to the racetrack, and she wins some money. And my wife didn't believe in banks back then. I said, what are you going to do with that money? She said, I'm going to buy a house and move you out of Portland. And I thought, oh, I'd like to get a hold of that money. I knew what to do with it. And she used to hide that money. And I took her back to the racetrack, and she wins some more money. And she would hide this money. And I never did find that money. And we bought the house that we live in today off of that money. But I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and my wife was given a lead, and she told where she used to hide that money, and I like to pass it on to my fellow alcoholic. Some Al-Anon told me, said, you shouldn't tell where our hiding places is. I said, well, I'm going to tell you, she don't hide it there no more because I've checked. But she used to hide it in flower pots. So if you're ever looking, turn them damn flower pots upside down, you know? Turn the house up good. You know, I never did find that money, and we bought a house, and they moved, and I didn't have nowhere to go, so I moved with them. And we got out into Shively, and I remember after we got out there, my wife looked at me one day, and she said, Larry, I know what's wrong. Barbara always knew what was wrong with me. And I said, what's that? And she said, nobody's ever taught you how to drink. I said, really? She said, I'm going to take you out tonight and learn you how to be a social drinker. And I thought, if she's buying, I'm going, you know. And she did. She got me in a car, and she took me out on Bardstown Road to a place called the Toy Tiger, a real nice place. We opened that door, and that band music was playing. I got snapping my fingers, and I thought, boy, we're going to have a good time tonight. And she ordered me a vodka and orange juice, and they set it down in front of me, and I went to chug a lug it down. She reached over, touched my hand. She said, no, 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 no. She said, you don't drink like that. She said, you sit here and you sip on that and you listen to the music. And she said something I'll never forget. She said, two of them ought to do you while we're here. I thought, boy, we ain't gonna be here long. You know. And I remember sitting in there and sipping on that vodka and orange juice, and I'd look across the table at her and she'd be smiling, and I thought, damn you, I hate you. You know, you don't want me to have no fun. And I stood it as long as I could, and I told her, I said, if this is social drinking, you can have it. And I snapped my fingers for that waitress, and she began to bring them drinks like I like to drink them. And when we left that night, my wife helped me out to the car, and she drove home, and she never took me back, so I guess I flunked social drinking, you know. But a lot of people's trying to help me by now, because my alcoholism is just like a roaring lion, man. I'm just going on. My family totally began to disintegrate. My children got to the point, I used to say my children got to the point that they hated me, but I know today that's not true. My children never quit loving me, but they got to the point where they sure didn't like me, because I was a total embarrassment to them. Me and my wife's talking about divorce all the time. I'm a painter by trade. If y'all heard about drunken painters, that's what I was. And I had a maintenance paint job by now, and, you know, things ain't going good in my life. My son was a football player in high school, and he would beg me to come to football games when he would play, and I'd tell him I would. And I want you to know I never missed a game that my son played in. But while my son was down on the field playing, there was a disturbance up in the stands. It was his drunken father up there fighting and carrying on. And my son won a lot of awards, and he would beg me to come to banquets. And I'd tell him, I'll be there. And you know, I never seen my son get one trophy. The closest I ever got was when my son was getting a trophy, his drunken father was laying out in the parking lot, passed out in a pool of puke. But I'd have told you, leave me alone. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. My two daughters, they quit having anybody over because they never knew what their drunken father was going to be. They were cheerleaders. And I embarrassed my children time after time. And some of the things that I did to my children, it's hard for me to talk about. I took my children, and through manipulation, I turned them dead against my wife. I used to get up in the morning, and my wife would be telling me all the things I'd do the night before, and my three kids would be sitting around the kitchen table, and I'd say, if your mother will shut up, we'll go to King's Island today. You know, going to take them somewhere real special? And their mother never would shut up. And I'd slam out the door, and my parting words was, if your mother would just leave me alone, I wouldn't drink so much. You know, I said that so many times that I used to hear my children tell their mother, Mom, if you'd just leave Dad alone, he wouldn't drink so much. And a lot of times she would be running her mouth in the morning, and she'd have her head turned, and the kids would be looking at me, and I'd say, your mother's nuts. You know, and I did that so much that my kids would say, Mama's nuts, ain't she, Dad? You know, and I'm not proud of that. And it took a long time for me and my wife to repair the relationship with our children. My wife had to work awful hard in a program called Al-Anon to establish a relationship with her children. And thank God for these fellowships that we've been able to do. But things was getting real bad, in 1974, I fell, and I'm sure the day I fell, I was drunk, because most days at work, I was drunk. I had to be rushed to the hospital and had to have back surgery, one of many that I've had. I'll tell you about them later. But from 1974 to 1978, alcohol and drugs completely consumed my life. I don't talk about drugs because I'll tell you why. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous takes care of every addiction I've got. I don't need a special program for anything. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 12 steps serves me well. And so that's why I don't talk a whole lot about it, because I got to do the same thing, whether it's snorting Pam up your nose. You got to go to AA and work a 12 steps if you're going to get recovered. But my life was a shambles, you know. I'm buying drugs off the street, and I'm drinking, me and Barbara's arguing, things are bad at home. It takes a lot of money to live like that. And I'm working extra work besides the job I got. You know, I was one of them functioning drunk, and I wasn't a real good worker. But I tell you what, I figured out real early that going to work was the least price to pay than to stay home with my wife. Because, man, I was going to hear that chin music all day long. And I thought, I think I'll go to work. You know, I got more peace at work. But I'm working an extra job, and my brother Norman called me up one Friday night, and he said, Larry, there's 25 of us going out and painting at the Ford Motor Company. Would you like to go with us? And I said, yeah, man, I need the money. He said, well, be ready in the morning. We'll pick you up. And at 5:30 in the morning, my brother Norman and my nephew honked the horn, and I went out and climbed in the car. And they had a bag of reefer laying on the front seat and a cooler full of vodka and orange juice, and they were shit-faced. And I looked at them, I thought, this is going to be a good job. You know? I knew we was going to have fun. We got out there, and it wasn't long till that vodka and orange juice was gone. I told my nephew, I said, I'm going home. He said, what's the matter, Uncle Aaron? I said, we ain't got nothing to drink. I can't stay here. He said, well, you can't get out. And I said, oh, man, you can get out of any place. And I looked around. They rode on little golf carts out there. And I went over and pushed the starter button on one of these golf carts, and it started up, and I whistled for my nephew. We got in the golf cart, rolled up to the gatehouse, told the guard we had to go after some paint. He let us out. We went to a liquor store. We got a bottle of whiskey for every pocket me and him had. We come outside, and we rolled up one of them funny little cigarettes, tried to figure out who was the smartest. That took a couple of hours. We decided we better get back because I knew my brothers was getting thirsty. My brother Norman was already rampaging. We went back, and as we went through the gatehouse, this guard spotted a bottle of whiskey in my nephew's pocket, and he grabbed it. And we got kind of belligerent with him. He said, I don't know what I'm going to do with you guys. He said, I'm going to call the captain and get him up here. Well, when he went to use the phone, we snatched up that bottle of whiskey, and we run out and jumped on that golf cart. And away we went. My nephew said, Uncle Larry, you better open this thing up. They're coming after us. And I looked back, and there was two guards, and they was on a golf cart chasing us. And I had this thing to the floorboard. You know, them golf carts won't go very fast. And we rounded this corner, and I looked over by this building, and there was the shiniest fire engine I'd ever seen in my life. Now, I've never drove one before, and I haven't drove one since, but I was going to drive that one. We pulled over by this fire engine, and he had the keys dangling from it, and me and him jumped in. Of course, I had to get in the driver's side, you know. And I don't know about y'all, but you can't drive a fire engine until you get the light and the siren going. And we got the light and the siren going, and away we went. And I remember my nephew waving by at them gone. But all my life, I had a constant need for attention when I was a kid growing up, and I still had it. And I thought, you know, it'd be a shame to steal this fire engine and not let my brother see it. I knew they wanted to see this fire engine. So this building, they was working way back in the back of it, and they had this highway, and it was just big enough to get this fire truck through. And we're going down through there, and we got that light spinning, we got that siren going, and there's people working, and they're diving everywhere. And my nephew's hollering, run over them, Uncle Larry, kill them. You know, and we took that fire engine right back to where my brothers and all them painters was, and they was real impressed. My brother's eyes got real big, and their mouth fell open. And every guard at the Ford Motor Company was impressed, too, because they all showed up there. And they was mad because we stole this fire engine. And we got to arguing with them, and one of these guards shoved me. I told y'all my brother Norman done my badly. And when this guard shoved me, my brother Norman hit one of them upside the head. And we had one of the biggest free-for-alls out there you ever seen. Now, I used to tell this story before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it went something like this, that we whipped every guard at the Ford Motor Company. But after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard about a word I wasn't real familiar with. It's called honesty. I'm going to tell you tonight what really happened out there at the Ford Motor Company that day. We got the shit beat out of it. And I was the littlest, and I got the worst. Man, they mopped the floor up with me. I had a hinky on the side of my head as big as a watermelon. And you know, they didn't lock us up. They threw us out of Ford Motor Company, and we stood out there, and we said, we'll be back. We're going home and get our pistols, and we'll show you how bad we are. But we got detained along the way. We run into a beer joint. Now, I'd been out all day, told you what kind of day I had. I hadn't had enough. I went home, got an old car I had, drunk car, had dents all in it. And my nephew dropped me off, and he took off, and I tried to catch him. The last thing I remember, I was doing 90 miles an hour, and I guess I passed out at the wheel. And I flipped that car five times, and I hit five trees. And my son, who had grew up in my alcoholism, was the first person to arrive at the scene of that wreck. And he pulled his dad out of that wreck, sure I was dead. They said he was screaming. And he said it had knocked the shoes clean off my feet. And he said, I had dirt in my mouth, and I spit that dirt out, and I said, give me a cigarette. You know, that had to be a traumatic experience for my son. But my son had grew up, and he was smart, and he knew if he left me there, the police was going to get me. So he got a buddy, and they took me home. Now, I don't remember the wreck. I don't remember much about the complete day. Well, when I woke up the next morning, I don't know about any of you all, but I was married to an attack dog by then. Most mornings when I had performed the night before, when I woke up, she would be sitting on my chest, and she would have that finger going. And she would give me blow-by-blow descriptions of what I'd done the night before. And she told me about this wreck, and I said, "Ah, man, if I had a wreck like that, I'd be dead." She got me in her other car and took me over to the junkyard, and I looked at that car, and I looked at my wife, and I said, "That's it. I'll never drink again." And I meant that with all my being, and I got drunk that night. But see, I knew nothing about a disease called alcoholism. If you can't call the shots, if you can call the shots, you don't need to be here. You know, because I couldn't no longer control when I drank, how much I drank, or what would happen to me. Alcohol had me by the throat and was taking me down. And right after I had that wreck, I went into my regular job. I had this maintenance paint job, and I'm over at the paint shop, and all the drinkers and the druggers was there, and my phone rang. This was in 1977. And I just told you what kind of weekend I had, and I was all beat up, had broken ribs from the fight. Man, I was in horrible shape. I weighed probably maybe 110 pounds. You don't get heavy on pickled pig's feet and weenies in them joints, you know. And my wife ain't cooking much for me. She'd give me cold shoulder and hot tongue by now, you know. And the personnel director called me, and they said, my buddy said, "What do you think he wants with you?" I said, "Probably wants to give me a raise, as good of an employee as I am." And I went over to his office, and he was staring out a window, and he turned around and looked at me, and he said, "My God, Larry, you look awful." And I thought, man, if you had the kind of weekend I had, you wouldn't look too swift either. To my knowledge, he was the first person to ever call me an alcoholic. He looked at me that morning, he said, "Larry, I know what's wrong with you." And I said, "Really, what's that?" And he said, "You're an alcoholic." And I got fighting mad. I stomped out of his office, and I went back over to the paint shop. And all my buddies was over there, and they said, "What'd Bill want with you?" And I said, "You all will never believe what he called me." They said, "What's that, Larry?" And I said, "He said I'm an alcoholic." They said, "Oh, man, he tells everybody, come on, have a beer." Who do y'all think I believe? You know, I left that man's office. That was in 1977, and I continued to drink for another year. And I don't know where you got in your alcoholism, but I want you to know that I took my wife and my three children, my mom and dad, my brothers and sisters, and anybody that cared anything about me, and I took their hands and I jerked them straight into the jaws of hell. That's where we lived the last year. Things just happened over and over and over. A year after I left that man's office, I'd been out with my brother Norman, and I overdosed on alcohol and drugs. And when I come to, I was in University Hospital down in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was in an emergency room, and I was strapped down on a gurney, and they had a tube in every hole I had. I was sick as a dog. And I'm laying on that gurney, and they had the straps across my legs and my belly and my arms, and I'm laying on that gurney, and a woman walked up to me. And I found out later she was a psychiatrist. And she said, "Larry, we're going to put you upstairs." Well, I knew what was upstairs in this hospital. It was called the Nut Ward. And I began to con and manipulate like I had done all my life. And I thought, she's going to lock my ass up. And I began to tell her, I said, "Lady, if you'll let me out of this hospital, I'm going to do something about my drinking and drugging." And she looked down at me, and I'm laying on that gurney, and she said, "Larry, do you really mean that?" Now, I'm strapped down on a gurney, but I could get my swearing hand up. And I looked up at her, and I said, "Lady, I swear to God, if you let me out of here, I'm going to do something about my drinking." And you know, she bought my story. And they undid them straps, and I left that hospital, and I did do something about my drinking. I stopped at the first beer joint I could find and got a six-pack. Because I want to tell you, by now, I had to drink to live. It was no longer an option for me. And that's where I was on November the 7th, 1978. And I got up that morning, and why this morning was to be any different than a million other mornings, I don't know. I know today that the hand of God was about to touch me. And I truly believe that my sobriety is a gift from God. I got up that morning, and I went into work, and I punched in, and I started over to the paint shop, and I walked by that personnel director's office. And I don't know why I stopped. And I sat on his steps. He wasn't in his office, and it was dark. And I remember sitting on that step, and I remember crying. I hope I never forget how I felt that moment. I thought, I can't do this one more time. I knew that if I walked off of them steps and I went over to that paint shop, I would never, ever get back. And he finally come in, and I was sitting on the steps, and I said, Bill, you told me about a place that could help me. Where is it? And him and my wife took me to a treatment center on November the 7th, 1978, and I had no idea that I was about to begin a journey as Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed 30 days in that treatment center, and I won't tell you how sick I was. I got out of that treatment center, and I went home to a wife and three teenage kids, and I thought we was going to be the Bieber family. Oh, God, if it was bad before the drinking, it was almost worse after. I went home, and I set my family down to the table, and I said, things are going to be different. And my youngest daughter went, oh, no. And I went to a meeting that night, and the guy that was become my first sponsor, a guy named Dave, I said, Dave, my family don't believe me. He laughed. He said, hell, I don't believe you either. He said, how many times do you think you've told your kids that? I said, about a million. And he told me something that I hope I never forget. He said, Larry, the greatest talk you'll ever make in Alcoholics Anonymous is the one you walk. Let them see the change in you. Now, I'd like to tell you that we was instant Bieber family, but it was awful. I helped court at the kitchen table. I know none of y'all's ever done this. And, you know, I'd get them all around dinner table, and I started giving curfews to kids that I hadn't even been in their life. And I started telling my wife, and, you know, I want you to know that I carried my sobriety like a club over her head. Too, I said, I'll get drunk. Man, she'd snap right too. That was before Al-Anon got a hold of her. But it was awful. And I used to throw temper fits. I'm sure not. I don't like to tell this story only because my sponsor says it's good for my humility. I used to jump up and down and beat on the table and throw little temper tantrums. And I think it was an Al-Anon, I'm not sure, that told me that I had a little brat inside of me and his name was Buster. And that I needed to spank Buster's ass and put him to bed. That Buster was running my life, and oh boy was he. It was awful at our house. The only thing that I can tell you that I done right is I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night. You know, and thank God for the people that was here and stood out in parking lots till midnight and let this madman rant. I don't know how I would have made it without him. My wife began to go to Al-Anon about the same time. I remember one night she wasn't doing just what I wanted her to. And I told her, I said, I'll get drunk. And she turned around and looked me dead in the eye and she said, who gives a shit? She said, your sobriety is your responsibility. I'll not take no credit for it and I'll not take no blame if you get drunk. And I thought, I got to get her away from me. I didn't like her Al-Anon sponsor. She was the meanest old woman I ever met in my life. And I hated her Al-Anon sponsor's husband even more than I hated her Al-Anon sponsor. And they was always trying to get me and Barbara to go places. Now, her Al-Anon sponsor's husband was the filthiest mouthed man I ever met, but he knew how to get to a guy like me. And I'd tell Barbara, I'd say, if Louie calls, you tell him we ain't going. And old Louie would call and Barbara would hand me the phone. And I'd talk to Louie and I'd say, what time y'all gonna pick us up? I was scared of Louie. He used a lot of four-letter words on guys like me, you know. And they began to get us involved with other couples. We didn't know how to be a couple. I want to tell you what, when we got sober, me and my wife used to just sit at a table and look at each other. We didn't know how to communicate. All we ever talked about was what I'd done the night before. You know, thank God for AA and Al-Anon. They give us our first bridge together. Something to talk about. Something we heard a speaker say. And it began the dynamic of trying to put a marriage back together. Of trying to put a broken family back together. My children, they had enough of us. My two daughters left home. They moved to Texas to be with my sister. My son, he began to fall in the back door drunk and loaded on grass, and I thought, how can he do this to me? as good of a daddy as I've been to this kid. And I had enough ego at that time, I thought, well, with all my vast experience, I'll straighten him out. If any of y'all trying to straighten out a son or daughter, good luck. You know, the more I tried, the worse it got. My son got so desperate, he joined the Navy. And that left me and Barbara. And thank God for AA and Al-Anon. We begin to go places. And I remember that they got us one night, and there was 50 couples, AAs and Al-Anon. And they took us to see a play called Camelot. And I fell in love with that play. And they had an intermission or a halftime, whatever you call a play. And I went out to smoke a cigarette. One of them big old tough buddies from Portland was out there. And he said, Larry, I didn't know you liked this kind of stuff. I said, hell, I didn't either. They didn't put them on where I hung out. It's only been through this fellowship that me and my wife has got to experience so much. I can never repay what the program has given both of us. We kept going to AA. We kept going to Al-Anon. I stayed sober a year somehow, a minute at a time. And I got my token in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the proudest and most surprised person in that room was me. And I remember after I got my token, I went to my sponsor. And I said, Dave, there's something wrong with me. And he laughed. He said, there's a whole lot wrong with you. He said, what's the matter, Larry? And I said, man, I see people around AA's got something I've never touched. And I said, I can see it in their eyes. And I can tell it. And I said, inside of me, I'm a mess. He said, you want more out of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, yes, I do. He said, you got to do more. And I said, like what? And he said, like the step. I hadn't looked at a step. I hadn't picked that big book up. All I had done was go to meetings. And I heard a guy from up here say, if dry is all you can be, you might as well get drunk. Man, I don't believe that. If you're sitting here tonight and you're dry, you stay here because you got a chance to get sobriety. And that's what happened to me. And I began with his help to read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to try and work the steps. We got that old four step. I said, I did one of these in treatment. He said, you've done one of them all right. It's been everybody around AA's and your wife and kids. He said, you need to do one of your own. And for the first time in my life, I sat down with a pencil and paper, and I took a real good look at this emotionally immature, spoiled little brat that had forgot to grow up. And I remember after I'd done my four step, me and him sat in the park. And for the first time in my entire life, I took my false face off and I let another human being know all about me. And I think that's real important. Because you let me think I'm a hot dog in this fellowship. You let that guy or that gal come in that room you've done that full step with, fifth step with, you get real humble. You know, I do every time I see him. Because he knows all about me. And he began to help me with the steps. And I went on and began to work the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th step. 12 steps. Now I want to tell you about a year in this program, I was dynamite, man. I was eat up with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I wanted to give it to everybody. And I used to get in my car, and me and another guy used to ride downtown in Louisville, and there was an old hospital down there, had closed down, and these old rhinos used to crawl up in them bushes at nighttime, and I'd drag them out and take them to detox. Man, detox got where they hated me. And it got so bad that them rhinos would see my car come downtown, they'd take off running. You know? And people would go to my sponsor and they'd say, you got to do something with Larry. And he said, oh, he's on his high horse. Leave him alone. He'll get tired. You know? And I finally got tired of dragging them. Well, them rhinos didn't want to get sober. They just want to lay in them bushes and drink wine. You know? And I was bothering them. But I wanted everybody to have it. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to get involved in every phase of this program that's possible. I began to get into service work. I did 12-step work, whatever it was, because I knew that I had found the deal, man, for me. I knew that this was the way I always wanted to live. I used to tell my wife, I wish my kids would come back. My sponsor said, be careful what you pray for. My children began to come home, and through that process, me and my wife has been able to reestablish a relationship with my children. Today, I've got a good relationship with my children. My oldest daughter still lives down in Texas, and I love her so much. She's got four grandkids today. She got a divorce and married a guy, and he had two, and we just went down there and spent about 9 days with them, and it was wonderful. This daughter that hated me so bad that if I was on fire, she would have poured a glass of water on me, calls me today, and asks my advice on her life. Man, that's amazing. And we tell each other we love each other. And her two kids, her four kids today, has never seen their grandfather take a drink. And I'm so grateful for that. They think I hang the moon, and I tell them I do, you know. My youngest daughter lives in Louisville, and she come back home, and we real got a relationship going with her. She got a job in the bank. She come home one day, and she said, "Dad, I got some tickets to the ballet." And I thought, whoopee, you know, a ballet. I've never been to a ballet in my life. And she said, "Will you and Mom go?" I said, "Yeah, we'll go with you." I wanted to be with my daughter. I didn't care about the ballet. And she had some seats right down in front, about three rows back. And we went and sat down, and they're getting ready to start this ballet, and this woman walks out on the stage. And she made a fatal mistake. She said, "Hi, my name's Kathy." And I hollered, "Hi, Kathy." I was the only person in that room that hollered, "Hi, Kathy." My daughter tried to crawl under the seat. She said, "Dad, you can't take you nowhere. AA has run you." But we have a good time. My son, David followed right in his dad's footsteps. My son has been in and out of jail. He's been in and out of prison. He's been in and out of AA. It's just about killed me and his mother to watch him. I know it wasn't long ago that I was down at the Cornhusker, and they'd called me, and my son had broke into my house and robbed me. And, you know, he was doing everything that I did. And I didn't know what to do with my son. You know, he wasn't living at home. He's living out on the street like an animal. And all I could do was pray to the same God that helped me. And I want to tell you, one day I was asked to come down to Louisiana to talk. And I didn't want to go. I was feeling bad. I was having a lot of back trouble. By now I'm retired on disability. And I told my wife, I said, "I'm not going. I don't feel like going." And she said, "Oh, let's go. It might be good for you." And we went down into Louisiana, and I made a talk down there. And after I got through talking, one of my daughters was there. And she said, "Dad, there's a guy over that wants to talk to you." And I said, "I don't want to talk to him. I feel bad. I want to go up to my room." And she said, "Oh, Dad, he's such a nice guy. Please go talk to him." And I went over to talk to this guy, and he just become one of my dearest friends. They began to come to Louisville to visit us, and we went back to Louisiana to visit them, and we just a wonderful relationship. And he called me up one day, and my son David was there. He'd come by the house to hustle me for a few dollars, and I found out I'd give him a couple dollars because I got rid of him. And he was sitting there, and this guy said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm talking to David." And he said, "See there?" He said, "Let me talk to him." And he got my son on the phone. He had never met my son before. And he was in AA down in Louisiana. He invited my son to come down and live with him. My son handed me the phone. He said, "Will you buy David a ticket?" I said, "One way." And I want you to know that my son went down to Louisiana, and he lived with this guy in his home. With him and his wife, they're both in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they could do for my son what I couldn't do. And my son, hey, I'm so glad he got nothing. And he began to go to meetings, and he began to work. And he began to call me, and we began to have a relationship again. And 4 months ago, my son called me up, and he said, "Dad, I want to come home." He said, "Can I come home and live with you?" And I said, "Yes, you can." And my son's been living with me the last 4 months. And we go to meetings together. And we talk about the steps. And I'm so grateful that my son found this fellowship. But can you imagine that God took me somewhere that I didn't want to go and talked to somebody that I didn't even want to talk to. And he sent a messenger for my son. That's the way this fellowship works. I can't help my son, but I can help your son or your daughter. And I have to leave my sons and daughters to you. And that's why this fellowship works. And I've got a good relationship. I'm retired on disability. I've had several back operations in the last few years. And, you know, things have been kind of tough on me. I had to retire. My wife is not feeling real well. You know, I had these back operations, and I had to have one of them, and it was a 10-hour operation. They had to put rods in my back, and they told me I was going to be laid up in a bed. Couldn't get out of bed for 2 months. I want you to know that AA people took care of me. You know, the doctor told me, he said, "Larry, you got to give 5 units of your own blood." I said, "Man, I ain't got 5 units of blood." And I was able to give two, and he said, well, you got to get some blood donated. And I want you to know that some of the guys that I sponsored went up and gave me blood. And I kid them about it. Today, one of them's name's Craig, and Craig's lazy. So today, when I don't want to do nothing, I tell my wife it must be Craig's blood. Another one's name's Bobby. Bobby's fairly new around the program. He's kind of hyper. When I have one of them bad days, I tell her it must be Bobby's blood. Another one's name's Todd. Todd's a young guy and he likes the ladies. If I stare at one of you ladies too long, I just tell Barbara it must be Todd's blood. But think about that. They went up and gave me blood, and I had this surgery, and it was a 10-hour surgery. And for the next 2 months, I had to lay in a hospital bed in my bedroom. And I want you to know that AA people come to my house, and they babysat me while Barbara went to Al-Anon meeting. And I'm going to tell you the most amazing thing. I couldn't even get up to go to a bathroom. And I want you to know that they emptied my urine. Now, if you don't think that's something, you call your old beer joint and ask your buddies to come over and empty your urine. And if they come, I'll drink it. A year ago, I had to have some more surgery, and I had to have some more blood. And old Craig went and gave me another shot, so I'm double lazy. And my sponsor, Jack, said, I'm going to give you some blood. I said, oh, Jack, you're too old to be giving me blood. He said, I want you to finally have some royal blood in your family. Now, Jack was an old wine old that slept in a cardboard box behind the Downs Cafe in Louisville, Kentucky, and he thinks his blood's royal. That can only happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to know that Jack went down. I told him, I said, you're a Marquette. I want his blood. And I'm proud to tell you today that I have my sponsor's blood. I changed sponsors because my first sponsor left the program and went back to church, and I'd asked Jack to be my sponsor. And I kid him today. Last week, I went to the races 3 times. I said, Jack, it's got to be your blood. I don't usually go, you know. But that's a real treat to know that I've got my sponsor's blood in me, and I hope that I can be half the member of Alcoholics Anonymous that he is. This program has given me everything. I have been on the highest mountain that it's possible to be on, but I also want you to know that I have been in the lowest valley that I can be on, and you have been there for me. When I had this last surgery, my wife had had a small stroke, and she's not real good with her balance, and she can't get up escalators or downstairs and trying to drive a car. I was in this hospital, and you had to go up this big long ramp, and she said, I can't come and see you. She said, I can't drive up this ramp. And I want you to know the little gal that runs around with our group there in Louisville, Kentucky, left her family for 3 days and come over and babysat it, my wife. And brought her to the hospital every night to visit me when I was in there. And you can have my grace. How in the world can I ever repay Alcoholics Anonymous for what it's done for me and my loved ones? I've been blessed to see some of my brothers come into this program. My brother Norman, that old tough guy, he come to Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't believe in holding hands. He wouldn't even let a lady hug him, much less a guy. He was a big, tough guy, and I want to tell you what happened to him. He stayed around this fellowship, and the most powerful force in the world is in this room. It's called L-O-V-E, love. And my brother stayed around this program until he felt that love, and he began to drop all them old tough ways, and me and him began to go to conferences, and his wife and my wife, and we run that everywhere. And my brother was 3 years sober in this program, and he called me up one day, and he said, man, I got some bad news today. I said, what's the matter, brother? And he said, I found out I got cancer. I said, how bad? And he said, I don't know, but I want you to go back to the doctor with me. And we went back to the doctor, and my brother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he was only given 3 months to live. And we walked out of that doctor's office, and he looked at me, and he said, will you be there for me at the end? Man, I hadn't been nowhere for anybody. I was a taker, not a giver. And I said, I'll be there, brother. And my brother lived exactly 3 months. And I spent just about the last 3 months of my brother's life with him in the hospital. And at nighttime, everybody would leave, and me and my brother would spend the night together. And I want to tell you what our night was like. Two big old tough guys. I used to pull a chair up by the bed, and I'd say, Norm, what do you want to do tonight? He'd say, why don't you read to me from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And we talked about God, and we talked about love, and we talked about death. I remember one night he was laughing, laying in that bed, and I said, what are you laughing about, brother? And he said, A.A. He said, they're the craziest people in the world, ain't they? I said, why? And he said, they laugh when they're supposed to cry, and they cry when they're supposed to laugh. But some nights my brother would be in so much pain, and they would have to put him, give him a lot of morphine at the last. And I'd watch my brother, and it was like I would die inside. And I want you to know that some A.A. or some Al-Anon would slip up through the emergency room at 2 o'clock in the morning to check on these two big old tough guys. Where in the world can you find love like that? My brother died in that hospital, and I felt like my world ended. But a guy told me, when you can't go any further, just hit your knees and ask God to remove the rocks or fly you over. And God began to bring me some of the god-awfulest pigeons in the world. They were just like my brother. And I got involved in their life. I haven't forgotten my brother, just like Benoy was talking about Jesus. You know, he's in my heart. But I know I got to stay busy in this program. And I'm so grateful that my brother got to meet you people. And he got to know the most powerful force in the world is love. And he was at peace when he died. And I'm grateful. And I know that what he would want me to do is to keep going on. And I sponsor all these nutty guys, and they're in and out of my house. Our house, mine and Barbara's house, is like Grand Central Station. You know, the phone rings all the time. And we wouldn't have it any other way because they saved my life. When I wanted to feel sorry for myself and crawl in a hole, they was there for me. My dad, that I told you I hated so bad, I was 2 years sober in this program. I got about 3 minutes. And I really didn't care a whole lot for my dad. I didn't have no relationship with him. And my dad got sick, and he was in his 80s. And my sponsor called me up, and he said, you want to go to a meeting? I said, no, I can't. I got to go to the hospital and see my old man. That's what I called him, my old man. He said, what's the matter? Don't you want to go? And I said, not particularly. He said, why not? And I said, man, he never did nothing to make my life miserable. He said, Larry, how can you want your children to forgive you and you can't forgive your daddy? He said, how in the world can you say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting and ask God to forgive you your trespasses and you can't forgive your daddy? He said, you don't hate your daddy. You hated what your daddy did. And he did it because of the disease called alcoholism. I was 40 years old and 2 years sober. And I walked into that hospital room and I knew I didn't hate my dad. Yeah, I hated the things he done. But I sat on my dad's bed and I took my dad's hand. And for the first time I can ever remember, I looked at my dad and I said, I love you, Dad. And he said, I love you too, son. We hadn't said that to each other because the disease of alcoholism divides fathers and sons and mothers and daughters and brothers and sisters. My dad got well. And me and him began to have one of the greatest relationships as possible. I never went to see my dad after that I didn't hug him and kiss him and tell him I loved him. My dad lived to be 92 years old. They say that's hereditary. And I was with my dad when he died. My mom's still alive today. My mom just turned 92 years old. They say that's hereditary. So I hope y'all get tired of hearing me. My mom lives by herself at 92 years old in an apartment about 10 minutes away from me. And me and my brother Ralph and my other brothers and my sister, we all take turns taking care of mom. And we all got little jobs we do. I told them I'd take my mom to the store. Now, if you've ever took my mom to the store, it's a real journey. It takes about an hour to an hour and a half. She likes to go up and down every aisle. She likes to pick everything up on the shelf and look at it. And I go over, try to, every Tuesday, and I take my mom to the store. You know why I do that? Not because I'm such a great guy. Because y'all learned me about making a meal. You learned me about trying to help my mama today for all the rotten things that I've done and what kind of a son I was. And my mom's got to see me sober for 18 years in this fellowship. She don't know much about AA, but she knows it's where her son needs to be. And I've got a good relationship with my mom today, and I love her dearly. She don't like for me and Ralph to get on them airplanes and fly. She don't know much about flying, but God has blessed me abundantly. I have relationships today I never dreamed was possible. I get to go places that And I've got a good relationship with my mom today, and I love her dearly. She don't like for me and Ralph to get on them airplanes and fly. She don't know much about flying, but God has blessed me abundantly. I have relationships today I never dreamed was possible. I get to go places that, you know, get to come here and hear in Benoit. That's a treat to me. And then to get to share my story. I used to think I didn't have a story. And a guy told me every bird whistles through his own beak. And we've all got a story. And you know, I've shared mine with you today. When I walked out of a treatment center, if you would ask me what my greatest fear was, I said, what am I going to tell my friends? And I believe that God gives you what you need. And I have a God today, a loving, merciful God that loves me abundantly. And I know that today. He has took care of me, and he has picked me up out of a gutter, and he has brought me to this fellowship. And sometimes I want more. And that's what gets me in trouble. I got to remember that when I got here, all I was looking for was a way to live in this world without alcohol and drugs. And God has blessed me with that and 10,000 more things. And I've got the audacity to sometimes to want more. And I try not to pray for things today. I just use the 11-step prayer. I pray only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. But God, give me a poem, and I close all my talks with this poem. And somebody in here may be having a rough day, and you don't know what to tell your friends when they want you to have a drink, and maybe you'll remember this poem. I got to put glasses on. Old age has caught up with me. It said, I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. I started down that lonely trail, some of my friends to find. I came to a signboard on the trail, the directions it did tell. Keep right to heaven, turn left to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing rake. I knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. I started down the rocky path that leads to Satan's place. I shook within, not knowing what I'd have to face. Old Satan met me at the gate. What's your name, my friend? I'm just sober sand that came to a sad end. He glanced through the yellow files. You made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here. I said, I'm looking for my friends. And a smile stole over his face. If your friends are alcoholics, they're any other place. So I went back the way I came to the crossroads I did see. Then I turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Pete smiled and said, come in. For you I have a birth. You are an alcoholic. You've had a hell on earth. I saw old Bud Pete Bill and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, all take warning. Learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to sweat. If someone tips you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell them you are going to heaven and they can go to hell. Thank you.